Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight for a discussion of The Majestic by the most majestic bastard I know, Adam Risky.
Thank you, Patrick, and I have to say that you've really come out of your shell since we gave you that clarinet.
Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. You should like our page on Facebook. And you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks once again to all of you who have taken the time to leave us a nice review in iTunes. It helps a lot. It helps our show get more popular. It helps raise the visibility of our show. And it's just super, super nice of you guys. The things that you write are really nice, and I appreciate you taking the time to do that. Only our past, like, 99 shows are in the iTunes store, so if you're new to the podcast and you want to hear all of our past episodes, go to fthismovie.net. We're going to be talking about The Majestic, but we should also mention that we are still in the throes of Junesploitation, our month-long celebration of exploitation in genre films. Go to fthismovie.net, watch a different movie every day, write about it on the site. Talk about these crazy movies with the people in our community. I was just having a back and forth about the movie Zombie Ass Toilet of the Dead. And there's not a lot of places you can go to talk about that without being arrested. So go to fthismovie.net for all your zombie ass needs.
I can't wait till I read it. How is Zombie Ass Toilet of the Dead?
Well, it wasn't my pick for the day. Somebody else had watched it, but I was all, hey, look, I've seen that.
Okay.
I believe it was Chaby who wrote about it, and so we were talking about it a little bit. It's crazy.
Chaby's got the Elias picture from Die Hard as his avatar.
That sounds right, yes.
I'm always a big fan of that.
Yeah. The guy that did Zombie Ass Toilet of the Dead, I want to say is the same guy that did... You saw ABCs of Death, right?
Why did you bring that up?
Do you remember the sequence about the Asian schoolgirls like sniffing each other's farts?
Yeah.
I think it's the same guy. I can't be sure.
Oh, goody.
But there's clearly a motif that runs through his work and involves Asian girls and farts.
It's unbelievable to me that somebody spent... You know, it takes, what, like 6 months, a year out of somebody's life to make a movie, and they chose to make Zombie-Ass Toilet of the Dead.
Listen, I'll give it credit for this. I've never seen it before. So we've got, you know, I've never seen that movie before. So we have like two, I've seen the movie, don't get me wrong.
That makes sense.
We've got about 2 weeks left in Junesploitation, so please do participate. And I guess that segues nicely into Adam Risky. Have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, I'll start with... the numero uno favorite of mine from Junesploitation, and that was Cyborg.
Yes!
I have to ask, how do you pronounce the director's last name?
I want to say it's Albert Pyun.
Pyun?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know if it was like Pwen or
no.
Pyun. Okay.
Are you talking about my boy Albert Pyun?
Yeah, you met
him. Who autographed that Cyborg poster that's right next to you?
He did. You know what's funny? You and I talked about the Cyborg director's cut months ago, and I hadn't seen Cyborg. It was on my bucket list of movies to watch. And I've heard, with the exception of you and this guy Davish from work.
Davish.
Davish, yeah, who like threw out his back playing basketball. Who does that?
Not me. I don't play sports.
Yeah, I don't.
I watch Cyborg like a man.
Exactly, like a boss. So I heard from so many people that it was bad for many, many years. And then I turned it on and I'm watching it. And 5 minutes in, I'm like, this movie's working. And I'm like, hold on, buddy, hold on. And then 5 more minutes, I'm like, it's still working. And then 15 more minutes in, I'm like, this is just good. And I really thought it had great atmosphere for a movie where they were using sets from other movies.
Yeah.
And it was exciting and interesting, and it had a good score, and it had an interesting villain. And I thought Van Damme was his usual earnest and likable self. And I don't know why. So I wrote in my blurb review for it for the day, if you don't like this movie, you might just be wrong. And I honestly feel that way.
I know. I totally understand people not liking it. Like, I think it requires certain sensibilities.
Pass.
You should... The director's cut is interesting because it's way more... I don't even know how to describe it. It's not more linear, but like it fills in some of the backstory more. It goes very heavy into the fact that the bad guys are Satan worshippers, and
okay.
They want to like rebuild the world in Satan's image. There's way too many mentions of Satan.
Well, what was the villain's name again? Fender? I think it was.
Yeah, everybody's named after guitars or musical instruments, if you didn't notice that.
Well, it's Warchild, like, from Point Break.
Yeah, it for sure is.
Yeah.
Everyone's name is like Gibson, Telecaster, and
exactly.
Fender, whatever.
And I had a weird dream actually last night where I was walking down a beach walk, and there were three groups of people, and it was like the Lost Boys, and I had to choose which one I wanted to be part of, and I ended up choosing like the Bodie camp.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Right next to them was Anthony Kiedis and Warchild and some other neo-Nazi guy, and they
that
were looking
would be
at us.
A waste of time. We're just gonna
fuck you up.
Just today, yeah. Teresa Palmer was cast in the Point Break remake that for some reason they're still going forward with.
That's the only casting so far that I think they've improved on the original choice.
God. No, Lori Petty's good in that. And I'm not a Lori Petty fan, but she works in that movie.
Teresa Palmer is adorable.
She is. I'm not disagreeing with you, but Lori Petty is a spitfire pug, fire.
Yeah, you just watched a League of Their
fire
Own.
Fire extinguisher. Yeah. She's a little.
I've been traded to Racine.
Fire. She puts out fires, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm delighted to hear that you liked Cyborg.
I was delighted also.
Not many people do.
I was having a bit of a dry spell for the beginning of Junesploitation, mostly to my fault for picking some kind of clunkers.
Well,
but,
listen, when you're trying to watch something new, you never know, you know.
Yeah, but
how it's gonna go.
I was just really relieved because I saw that after a run of like Nightmare on Elm Street 4s and Cobras, Toxic Avenger, Above the Law, which was not as fun as
every movie you're naming is like better than stuff I saw.
All Cheerleaders Die, which was
I think I liked
it more
than me.
Than
it
you.
Sounds like, yeah,
because you compared it in your review. I reread that after I watched it to a not very good Buffy episode.
Yes,
and all the stuff that people like Buffy for are the stuff that I don't like about Buffy because I think it's kind of very too clever by half, maybe.
Okay.
And All Cheerleaders Die seem to be just clever enough in the right amounts.
Okay.
It didn't seem like it was laughing at itself as much as the other Joss Whedon joints.
Yeah, I mean, the cleverness and the hipness of the dialogue for me is not what I think is great about Buffy. But you probably didn't like watch the whole series, right? Because if you realize this kind of irritates me, there's no reason why you would continue watching.
I watched it for the first couple of seasons in my huge Geller crush, and then I kind of cooled off.
For me, there's great storytelling and character stuff that happens underneath it. And for me, All Cheerleaders Die was like the snark without all the good stuff that is underneath the Buffy. But, you know, whatever. It's not the worst movie I've seen this year.
Yep. Did you see the worst movie you've seen this year?
Probably not. Okay. I mean, I have seen I don't know what the worst movie
is. Well, naturally. Yeah. So, all right.
It's got to be something I saw with you, right? We see real garbage together.
Yeah, I don't know if that's just on purpose.
No,
or
it's not.
I think it's on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're the person who texts me. You're like, I need an idiot to go see Machete Kills with. So, and I'm just like, ooh, Patrick's my friend.
That was not good. So what else besides Cyborg?
Okay, 22 Jump Street.
Yes.
I want to talk about.
All right.
This has been an interesting weekend because I don't want to talk about How to Train Your Dragon 2 because I wrote a review for it. But
which will be up by the time this podcast comes up. So go to fthismovie.net and read the review.
Cool. But I had a similar feeling that I haven't had before in reference to both sequels. And I don't know if this has to do with just the mood I was in or what. But I can recognize that they're good movies, but I don't like them very much.
Okay.
And with 22 Jump Street, I thought that it was funny. I'm not going to deny that. I did laugh a lot. But this, especially there's like a White House Down joke that I thought was the most amazing thing ever. it had nothing to do with Tatum or Hill. It was just all Phil Lord and Chris Miller. And I'm really irritated by them.
Interesting.
I feel like they extend jokes way too long
on occasion.
They are very impressed with themselves. They take cleverness to a degree that I do not respond to past a certain point. Like, for example, the end credits, which I won't spoil.
Right.
It's a joke that is not funny anymore after about 30 seconds to me. And I and it goes on and on.
People are going nuts for that end credit sequence. And there's a lot of really funny stuff. But I will agree with you in that it peaks at a certain point.
Yeah.
And then just repeats itself. But but doesn't stay or get funny or get funnier. And you kind of have to do that. Like, if you're going to keep it going, it has to keep getting funnier.
And not to jump around, but this with the Lego movie, I like the Lego movie more than 22 Jump Street. But one thing that kind of bugs me about them, and this is just, I don't know, I'm a weird guy when I think of movies sometimes and I overanalyze them. But all right, the Everything is Awesome song. Hmm. In the context of the movie, it's making fun of the people who really like that song.
Right.
But it's a song that's very catchy that kids like.
Right.
So aren't the filmmakers making fun of children then? And they're making fun of their own audience?
No, I don't think so.
All right.
I don't think so.
I'm in the minority, but like Phil Lord and Chris Miller are not my cup of tea.
Sure.
And then I saw Hate Ship, Love Ship, which
I still have not seen.
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay.
JB talked about it. I don't want to step on his recommendation because he did like it, I know. I don't know. My problem with it was just kind of Kristen Wiig was miscast. She seems too savvy of a person to play the character that she was playing.
Okay.
She's like, remember that character on Muppets who's always like, me, 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 me?
Beaker,
yeah,
sure.
Beaker. So that's what her character is like.
Interesting.
She's very
easy to memorize those lines, though, which is kind of nice.
It was, yeah. It's got like a love story in it that doesn't make any sense because she's supposed to fall for Guy Pearce, who's like a really just messy drug addict, I don't get it. And Nick Nolte's in it, and he's all like wooing Christine Lottie, but he's got like his Nick Nolte voice where he's just like, romance, and it's really creepy, and I mean, it's
you make me want to be a better man. Do you want to go out to dinner? I want the fairy tale.
He's doing lines from Pretty Woman. He's Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman.
I ate a pancake and the pancake reappeared. She rescues him right back, son.
But I'll give credit to the movie where I think that it's going
never
to
let me go, Jack.
Is that Titanic?
Yeah, yeah, I'm switching it up.
Okay.
Rose DeWitt Bucator.
So, Hate Ship, Love Ship, it resolves like halfway through the movie, so then it's got like a whole other movie that they're not advertising, which I was kind of like, okay.
Well, I literally have not seen one trailer, read one plot synopsis.
It's like such a, you know, actor's workshop movie where Kristen Wiig wanted to put on her serious pants and go to work. So, I mean, good for her. It just didn't. I didn't hate ship it. I didn't love ship it. that's my tagline. That's my blurb.
That's pretty good.
I saw Adult World.
Okay. I prefer to call it Adult World, but go ahead.
Adult World.
It's where I do all my shopping.
With
Cusack and Roberts.
Emma Roberts.
Not Julia.
Not Julia. Remember the last time
you're
we
my
talked?
Niece, right? I love trouble. Troubled nieces.
They were in that together.
Ooh.
Nolte and Roberts.
I know.
That's where it passed over. Duo. That's where they did their body swap that nobody knew about.
As Don John would say, got me hard as a fucking rack. So, yeah, Jogo, I'm quoting DJ. D to the J. Hit record on that, bitches. Anyways, So Adult World it's a movie about a girl who's a poetry student. She can't find work. She's just kind of on the margins. She ends up working at an adult bookstore and trying to subsidize her career as a poet. In the meantime, John Cusack plays her mentor of sorts. He completely phones in the performance.
Yeah, he's done that for a while now.
Yeah, he's not really trying at all.
He's in the paycheck phase of his career.
He really is, yeah. Evan Peters is in it, who plays Quicksilver in the X-Men movies.
Sure.
He's probably the best part of the movie, and when Evan Peters is the best part of your movie, you've got Adult World. And Emma Roberts, the last time we talked, I kind of supported her. Because
yeah, you said
I was
she was good
like,
in that
she was,
Franco movie.
Yeah, she was good in Palo Alto, and then
Palo Alto.
There's going to be a lot of giggling if you keep nolting this up. So it's kind of like, I feel like I need to do a take back because Emma Roberts is terrible in Adult World.
Okay, that's more in line with the Emma Roberts I know.
She's over-caffeinated and just awful. And you know a movie this reminded me of? And this is going to be like, oh, Art School Confidential.
Oh, gosh.
That's what this movie reminded me of.
I saw that movie and remember so little of it. Was that Max Minghella?
Yeah. Okay. It was just, it's like a copy of a copy of a copy of Ghost World. And it's just not good. It's one of the two or three worst movies I've seen all year.
Whoa.
With Sabotage and, I'm sorry, Knights of Badassdom, but it's not your boy's cut, so yeah, I feel right, saying that.
Yeah.
So skip it completely. And then I saw The Pretty One with Zoe Kazan in a dual role.
I'm out.
But Zoe Kazan got to act with her favorite actress, Zoe Kazan.
Yeah, yay.
It's kind of funny because one twin she's playing is cosmopolitan.
Wait a minute.
And the other twin she's playing is very dowdy and very yarn barnish. And she has a scene where the two of them are
dancing. We're totally different twins.
She has a scene where they're dancing together and the yarn barn one looks like Ed Grimsley. It's just like really weird double acting. Yikes. But then it was one of the Blacklist scripts.
Those rarely turn out good, by the way.
Okay. This one turned out decent.
Okay.
It wasn't great in the beginning.
Does it turn out that they're creepy gynecologists at any point?
No.
Okay. Check out my new vagina tool.
What was the name of Eddie Murphy's character in 48 Hours?
Reggie. Reggie something. Yeah, I don't remember.
You're a convict.
So, yeah, it was good. It's saved by Jake Johnson. Jake Johnson is awesome.
Okay.
And he brings out the best in Zoe Kazan.
All right.
So it turns into this nice little relationship movie, which I'm a sucker for. And I didn't think it was great, but I mean, like, it was something that was, I think, I don't even think it was on VOD. I just got out of Redbox.
I don't think I've even heard of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, like, I wouldn't rush out to see it, but it was a pleasant surprise, especially after Adult World.
Are you excited about Let's Be Cops? Starring Jake Johnson and Damon Wayans Jr.?
I want to be.
Sure.
The trailers are kind of iffy.
Maybe the trailer just is bad. Every trailer I saw before 22 Jump Street made me think that comedies are over.
Yeah.
It was all Sex Tape this and Dumb and Dumber 2 that and Let's Be Cops. I'm excited about The Interview. That was about the only one.
The Interview looks fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on board for Seth Rogen, so.
Yeah, exactly. Dumb and Dumber 2 looks pretty rough.
Really rough. Like, it even looks like one of the worst photographed movies of the year.
Yeah, I was mad at people in the theater for laughing at, like, the old lady hand job thing.
Oh, come on, funny. Like, she has dust in her vagina.
It's funny because she said giblets, and we know, giblets! It was gross.
Let me get my new speculum. Pass me the vagina tool, Beverly. Three Fugitives.
Nolte just every once in a while says one of his own movies. That's his big move. He talks to his creepy twin and then just says, North Dallas 40.
I think he just sleeps on the set and then somebody just shakes him and then he's just like, Hulk!
Nolte bubble.
Yep.
The only movie that I saw that's really not Junesploitation related is that I finally saw Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit.
Good for you.
Which you reviewed earlier this year.
And I liked.
And way more than me.
Interesting.
I did not find a lot to like, and maybe it's the difference between seeing it in a theater and being able to give it your undivided attention and trying to watch it at home and being bored out of your fucking mind. It was such a weird prequel for no reason, and maybe some of it is the marketing too, because I mean I don't want to spoil anything, but the marketing really makes it seem like there's a shadow conspiracy between Keira Knightley and Chris Pine, and
which doesn't make sense because you know the name of the character.
I had to look it up on IMDb. I didn't know that she was playing
the Ann Archer character.
Yeah. I didn't know that. So so then it's like, so I know where this is going. I know how this turns out. I thought they had no chemistry, and I like both of those actors.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it had no insight into the Jack Ryan character at all. I thought Kenneth Branagh was kind of a bad villain. I didn't really like, except that I thought it was like photographed okay.
I feel like I got everything I ever need to out of it the first time I saw it.
I would imagine so.
Like I got away with something, and if I go back to it, I'll realize I like it less. But I did enjoy it when I saw it in the theaters.
And it came out in like January.
I was going to say, I think that's part of what it was because in January and February, I'm looking forward to junk because I'm all prestiged out.
Right. And I've seen all the other Jack Ryan movies, and I don't love any of them. Like, they're fine movies. They're all well made, and they're fine. They're just not movies that I go back to over and over again. But I thought this was the weakest of them all. But, you know, whatever. Otherwise, it's all Junesploitation this and Junesploitation that. Should we talk about The Majestic?
I would love to.
I'm going to let you start because this was your goddamn idea.
Okay. Interesting. I wonder if that's a hint of what's
coming. It's not really.
What's to come.
It's
okay.
Not really.
Yeah, so I picked The Majestic for a number of reasons, mainly because it's a movie that I felt like defending.
Okay.
It's a movie that I really love. I saw it on New Year's Day 2002. I remember that it was the first movie that I saw of the new year, and that it was something that I wasn't looking forward to because I had heard how bad it was for about 10 days. And I was upset because Frank Darabont's a director that I liked a lot, and I still like a lot. And I was kind of bummed out also because critics were really picking on it. And it wasn't just, this is a bad movie. It was making worst of the year lists.
Really?
Yeah, I remember like Salon or Entertainment Weekly. Yeah. Okay. There was a few that like really panned it hard. Kenneth Turan, like, who just wrote a book on like the 54 greatest movies of all time and barely includes like 2001 and like all these other things. It's just unbelievable. I don't understand. There's no accounting for taste. I really want to defend.
I'll do anything.
That was supposed to be a musical. Me singing. I think that The Majestic has a lot of really interesting themes in it. It's like multiple movies in one.
Yes, it is.
Which I like all of them.
Okay.
There's also I don't know, I'm just glad it exists because this is the type of movie where a director cashed in all of his goodwill to make the movie that he really, really wanted to make, which is a 1950s Frank Capra schmaltz-a-thon. And he was only able to do that because of all the cachet that he got critically from The Shawshank Redemption. And then also The Green Mile was really profitable. So he was able to do this. This was based off of a script that a friend of his wrote, like a high school friend of his wrote. And it was not a Darabont script, which is rare for him. I also think that the movie's somewhat autobiographical, because it has a lot of commentary on writing and being a writer in the Hollywood system. And it's just always worked for me. And I've never had a viewing where I haven't been head over heels in love with this movie.
That is so fascinating. Okay. I like the movie. I liked it when I saw it back then. I still think it's okay. I've never really given it much thought. Like, it's The Majestic, and it pushes certain buttons. I have a nostalgia for the period, even though I didn't live through it. It's about this old movie theater. It's this feel-good movie. It's about Hollywood and old Hollywood and all these things that I kind of like seeing on screen. So I've always just thought it was pleasant enough, but never really gave much thought to it. And as is our way, and this rubs some people the wrong way. You know, we've gotten some negative feedback before, as has everyone who is a critic, from people who say, like, why do you have to think about why you like something? Like, why can't you just like it? Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's valid, but part of the fun of being movie fans and talking about movies is thinking about why you like something or why you don't like it. Because that's the only way you learn anything about yourself.
It's intelligence.
Right. And about the thing that you like or don't like. So as soon as I started the movie, to me, as soon as I start examining it, doesn't totally hold up. Like, I think it breaks down pretty fast. And I forgot that it wasn't a Darabont script, and I wonder if it would be better served by being written by Darabont. I, like you, like the fact that it exists, because I can tell that it was made with a lot of passion, that he really means it. I like seeing this side of Frank Darabont, because his next movie would be The Mist, which is 180 degrees in the other direction.
I almost wonder if this movie, or if The Mist was partially in reaction to The Majestic,
yeah.
Because he was always kind of more inclined to darker material, because he wrote the scripts for The Blob and Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and I think they were more like writer-for-hire type of jobs than anything. But this was his most sincere and kind of hopeful and positive project that he's ever done.
Yeah.
And The Majestic, or the Mist, yeah, as you said, is just a complete 180 from that.
And in the movie geek community, Frank Darabont is a hero. You know, we all love Frank Darabont. And it's interesting because he's only made 4 movies.
Yeah.
And the general consensus on 2 of them is that they're not that great. You know, there's not a huge community of people that love this movie, and I don't even think there's a huge community of people outside of the audience for TNT that loves The Green Mile.
Yeah, The Green Mile is my least favorite of the 4 of those.
Probably mine too. Yeah. It's basically Shawshank, and then sort of the hardcore people love The Mist.
Mm-hmm.
People love The Walking Dead, but he was bounced from that after 1 season.
Yeah.
He wrote he wrote Nightmare on Elm Street 3, he wrote The Blob, which, by the way, is coming out on Blu-ray in October.
Sweet.
Limited run of like only 5,000 copies, because it's one of those Twilight Time titles. So if you do snag a copy of The Blob 88 on Blu-ray, just send it to fthismoviepodcast @gmail.com, because I really want one. I love that movie.
Subtle.
Look at that blob.
Darabont, I'll be in a movie of yours.
So I like a lot of the different movies that are in The Majestic.
Yeah.
I just don't know if they all work together. It seemed like Frank Darabont wanted to make several different movies, couldn't decide.
Yeah.
Sort of clumsily pasted them all together. So I don't know how much the Capra-esque stuff works with the statements on McCarthyism, works with the stuff about being a writer. Again, I like a movie that tries to be more than one thing, so I have to give it credit for that. It just, watching it this time more critically, because I knew we were going to be talking about it, certain things started to not hold up.
Yeah, I think it's a movie that is, its flaws are very evident. It's not something where you have to give a lot of thought to what doesn't exactly work in it. There's a lot of over-the-top characterization, especially with the HUAC committee. And it's just never gotten to the point where those things bother me enough, where it's taken away from me being really interested with the, I'll start with the writer conceit. So the movie starts with Jim Carrey being this really coward writer. He just cares about his career. He doesn't care about anything going on in the world. He says later in the movie that he, you know, was the closest thing that you could be at the time in a, you know, mandatory enlistment to basically being like a Dodger. So he was thrilled that he didn't have to go overseas. He's non-political. He tries to just kind of look out for himself. And in the writer conceit, he's just a complete pushover, because he'll do anything that the studio executives are telling him to do. He's not, he has no backbone whatsoever. And that's one thing that I like about his character arc, is that he has to be shoved into being a man of action and a man of character by the end of the movie. And it's not something where it just kind of all of a sudden occurs to him. He has to be like nudged every step of the way to do it. And I think it's just interesting how far into the movie he carries those traits.
Okay.
But from like a writer perspective, and I think from an autobiographical perspective, I think Darabont in certain ways is sort of commenting on studio interference with his scripts, because he wanted Peter Appleton, the writer character that Jim Carrey's playing, he wants to do A Pictures, and he's doing B Pictures, The Sand Pirates of the Sahara, whereas Ashes to Ashes is his big Grapes of Wrath A Picture that he wants to do. And one thing that I think is very clever, that, and I'm not a fan of clever, but I think it works for me for some reason in this case, because it's more sincere than clever, is that The Majestic as a movie after his car accident is that A picture that he wants to write.
Okay.
he's the lead of a movie that he would want to write.
Right.
And I think that knowing what I know, which is not a lot, about, you know, the House of Un-American Activities Committee, the resolution for his character at the end, and I won't go into spoilers. Okay, so
we're spoiling The Majestic, everyone.
So he's absolved very quickly of his wrongdoings after the hearing, after he speaks up against the Congress. That didn't happen in real life.
Right.
So he has this fairy tale Hollywood ending, his Frank Capra ending, his It's a Wonderful Life ending, to his Blacklist story. And I almost think that the movie works as kind of like, if that's what Ashes to Ashes was, that's like his A picture. That's like his little movie there. And I read from Wikipedia, of all things. Darabont had huge studio interference with like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. He wrote a script for it, and he said that Kenneth Branagh just like ruined it completely, that it was just an abomination. Like, he took everything. And he's just like, you think this is game, Jack? So he just like ruined it completely. So I think
we need to have a show that's just Branagh and Nolte doing a podcast on The Majestic.
You think this is game, Nolte?
I like Jim Carrey. I like when he talks out of his butt. You want to see me do that, Ken?
I like when I drink Knob Creek out of my butt and then I throw it up. Yeah, so I think Darabont with the executives is kind of taking a jab at some people that he worked with, some collaborators who like took his movies and screwed with them. So that's from the writer perspective. I think it's less mysterious why I really love all the stuff with the old movie theater. If I could have any dream retirement job, it would be restoring an old movie theater.
With Martin Landau?
No, not okay. With Martin Landau. Okay. As I call him, Geppetto. He's the real deal.
A weird thing with Martin Landau, because he's great in some movies, you know, like he's great in Ed Wood.
Sort of.
I don't know about that.
All right, we could talk about that.
Sometimes I think he's so great in Ed Wood and in Crimes and Misdemeanors. Like, I've seen him be so good, and then sometimes I'm just like, he is a cartoon. What is he doing?
He's got one scene in this movie though that just kills me. I think it's great. It's when he goes into the box office and takes down the flag for the fallen soldiers and takes down his son's picture, which, by the way, and I'm going to point out things that I don't like about The Majestic because I don't want it to be just a complete gush fest. But one thing that really bugs me is you would think that more people would recognize him. That's something that really bothers me in the movie.
Yeah, I mean,
it's only been 9.5 years, and you would think that like the father of the woman he was going to marry would kind of come to it a little bit quicker.
Yeah, that is one thing that I've always just, you have to suspend it in order for the movie to work at all. Because if you can't get past that, then you can't accept the conceit of the movie. So I've just always had to go with, okay, they all think it's Luke, you know?
Yeah.
But I want to touch back real quick on what you were talking about, that scene at the end with the House on American Activities. Like, not only are Bob Balaban and Mark Twain, like, not doing a great job, like, Hal Holbrook just pounding his gavel over and over, and Jim Carrey just winning with the power of optimism. I don't mind that the movie tries to look at that period in history, and I think it's interesting the way it sort of contrasts that with the sacrifice made by people in World War II, and that there's some interesting commentary made at the end, like, this is not the America that these people fought for.
Mm-hmm.
This is small and petty and shitty what you guys are doing. And that is all interesting stuff and worth being said. But I also think that in a way, the movie does that dark period in American history a great disservice by essentially fixing it in the span of one hearing, where like all you need to do is stand up to them and read some verses, not verses, some passages from the Constitution, and it'll shut them down. Because, I mean, that ruined lives for years. That ruined careers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was some dark, dark stuff.
Yeah.
And it kind of all gets swept under the rug so that Jim Carrey can find his courage. And I also find it a little strange the way that even that resolves, where he just well, I gave him another name, and so I'm off the hook, and we're supposed to be happy. And the movie tries to say, well, they already had her name, so you didn't do anything wrong.
And she was the one who named you, so he's completely off the hook.
But it's like the end of Source Code, where it's like, I'm supposed to be happy.
I like Source Code.
I like Source Code, too. But
I like it, too. I only get to go back in time for 7 minutes.
I like Source Code as well, but there's this weird thing where it's like, yeah, sure, our hero gets a happy ending, but at the expense of another ruined life, you know? So I found that a little strange, but whatever. I wish that the movie was, if it was going to take on McCarthyism, I wish it was willing to do it in a way that treated it a little bit more seriously. I think it takes it a little lightly.
Yeah, there are a few other movies that do deal with it in a more serious light, but I think if I could knock something fundamentally about the movie, I would agree with you. It's something that they probably shouldn't have used as an approximation of the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington ending that they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe like just find a different thing or something to stand in for McCarthyism that isn't exactly, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because you can see that that's clearly what they're trying to go for is like that big rousing courtroom thing. Yeah. And I think maybe, and it's got no fault of the acting, really. I mean, like, obviously, like, Holbrook and Balaban have to be just completely one-dimensional and ridiculous because they're representing evil.
Right.
I mean, like, that's what they are there to do. One thing I wondered, though, is Jim Carrey, I think, gives a really good performance in the movie. He's a cheesy actor, and I'm a fan of Jim Carrey, but he's a cheesy performer. And I wonder if Jimmy Stewart, if they made this movie in the 50s and Jimmy Stewart played this part, if it would come across as marginal or if there would be something just in between the lines because of his skill as a performer that would kind of give it some more weight and some more gravity.
Jim Carrey is one of my problems with this movie. Okay. And I don't hate Jim Carrey. I don't particularly love Jim. I'm indifferent. I take Jim Carrey on a case by case basis, you know, like sometimes I think he's good. Sometimes he bothers me. I've seen him do dramatic work that is effective. Mm-hmm. I think he's good in The Truman Show because I think it uses some of his skill set against him and sort of plays against his public persona. I think he's good in like Eternal Sunshine. This movie, and I've always had this weird issue in the back of my head, and just rewatching it last night, I think I finally pegged it. It all seems, not all, a lot of it to me comes across as insincere. It's a guy trying to be this thing, and you could say that that's true of the Luke character, not the Luke character, but the
Peter character.
Yeah, the Peter character. But I don't think it's an actor's choice. I think it's the limitations of Jim Carrey. And here's what I'll compare it to. You are not a big Groundhog Day fan, correct?
No, I like it.
Okay. I don't know why I thought you weren't. Do you remember the iteration of Bill Murray in that movie where he's trying so hard to like have the perfect day where he's rolling around and laughing with Andy McDowell and he's like crazed, like, isn't this so fun and special and magical? It's kind of near the end when he thinks he's figured out his way out.
Yeah.
That to me is the Jim Carrey performance in The Majestic where he's trying really hard to be like, isn't this
sincere?
Isn't this sincere? Yeah. But it's all sort of he's putting it all on.
Yeah. The whole movie's kind of pitched that way though.
Yeah.
I mean like his performance is completely in the tone of the movie, I think.
I guess. And maybe that's another one of my issues with the movie that it feels like one step removed from what it wants to be. Like it so badly wants to be this Frank Capra movie that it becomes a commentary on Frank Capra movies instead of, I feel like had Darabont pitched the movie a little bit differently or just, I don't mean to suggest he should have modernized it in any way, but in some way made it his own more. I feel like it could have had the heart and the feel of a Capra movie without just trying to be this approximation, because at times it feels like Far From Heaven, where it's like, look at this stunt that I've created. It looks and feels like a Capra movie.
It's very production designed. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that Far From Heaven comparison is pretty apt, because there's really not that much of a difference between the two of them.
Right, except...
except one is intentionally calling out
right.
that it's trying to mimic the beats and the tones of it, and then the other one, The Majestic, is trying to be its own thing.
Right. I try not to be cynical with a lot of movies, and there's sure. plenty of movies where I go into and for whatever reason I'm too cynical and I just can't be won over by it. And then there are other movies where it resists all of my cynicism, and for as over the top sort of sincere as it is, I'm just like, yeah, I'm on board. This is great. But the scene for me where it always kind of breaks down is when they're having their first date, where Jim Carrey and Laurie Holden are sort of having their first date, the walk through the town.
Oh, okay.
And then we get the hilarious yep. wide shot where the whole town is following them.
You would never notice that.
And it just becomes...
Where'd they come from?
it's just a little too cutesy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It sure is. And I respond to bullshit.
I respond
sometimes.
To it up to a point. Yeah. But that to me is like...
That's a shot that I don't like. I mean,
that's
it's
some
not,
Gary Marshall shit yeah, right there.
That's a shot that I don't like.
Gary Marshall made Pretty Woman, is what I'm saying.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I love trouble. While we're on the topic of shots or scenes, I guess, that are just ridiculous, the one that always... It almost loses me because, like, it's right at the beginning of the movie, and I'm almost thinking it's a miracle that it gets me back at all, especially as much as it does, is when he walks into the typing room and the secretary is just like, oh, Pete, I'm not even supposed to be talking to you. And then there's a shot of her, like, running the full length of the office away from him. Yeah, she might as well just have her hands like waving in the air, like copy. Oh,
I love that first shot of him sitting in the chair in the office.
Yeah,
I like that shot, and it gets repeated later. And
Gary Marshall,
exactly, he's there pitching Pretty Woman.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, yeah.
The Princess Diaries.
I like caramel. I also like, I will say, a couple weeks ago on a podcast, I don't remember what movie I was talking about, but I mentioned that I don't like movies where, like, the guy has a secret, and then he knows as soon as everyone finds out, they're going to hate him.
Yeah, you'd hate the pretty one.
So he keeps it a secret for as long as possible, and then everybody does hate him, but then they forgive him. You know, it's that, it's the beat of, I don't know, every romantic comedy ever. So I don't like that. And as I was watching The Majestic, it had been a couple of years since I had seen it, because we get to the moment where he realizes that he's not Luke.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go to the funeral. And then at the funeral,
to Martin Landau's funeral.
Yeah, yeah. Funeral. And then at the funeral, he tells Laurie Holden, I'm not Luke.
I think that's so great.
So do I. Yeah. I forgot that it happened that quickly.
Yeah.
And so as it started to happen, I just was like, holy shit, he's not going to just keep it a secret for weeks and weeks. Like, no movie ever does that, where he makes the realization and then fesses up and tells the truth.
No, exactly. And he finds out earlier, but there's one thing, another moment that I really like is on Martin Landau's deathbed, he doesn't tell him.
Right, yes.
And that's just because... it's just the right thing to do.
Exactly.
And that's something that it gives the audience credit for being intelligent, that that's what they're doing.
Do you ever get the impression that Martin Landau knows?
I don't think that he does.
Okay.
I think that he thinks that it's his son.
Okay. I don't know. On this viewing of that scene on his deathbed, I part of me was like, I wonder if he knows and just chooses to believe the lie, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, a lot is said in the movie of the town having experienced just so much heartbreak that they're just willing to be almost naive to the fact that, you know, it's not necessarily Luke. It's just someone who is like a breath of fresh air in their town. And they're rebuilding the movie theater. It's just they're doing something positive in a town that's just seen so much, you know, sadness. And I kind of like that because it also ties in at the end. I mean, they're looking for, I don't know, I'm a sucker for movies where people are kind of being altruistic or going over and above themselves, and especially what they think they're capable of. And the part that always gets me at the end of the Majestic is when they're holding up a sign that says Lawson's favorite son. And it's like they've adopted him because he's represented everything that they stand for and the soldiers that died from their town stood for. And that always kind of breaks me up. And it's the same thing with like Silver Linings Playbook, where it's like he's really trying to improve himself and he's making a concerted effort to not backslide. And that thing, yeah, that type of thing is always gets me. It's funny because the Majestic, I recognize on this viewing and other viewings, there's so many things in this movie that are just a mark for me in particular,
right.
And it just hits those things. It's the rebuilding of the movie theater. I mean, like when I see that damn marquee light up, I mean,
well, could he fetishize it anymore?
Oh
like,
my God,
in the last half
gorgeous.
Hour of the movie, it just becomes marquee porn.
Oh God, it's just so gorgeous, though. I mean, I mean, it works for me. I don't know.
Go slower on that marquee, Frank.
Did you notice what one of the last movies that they're showing is, though? I had never noticed it until this viewing.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Clever, Frank.
Yeah.
Two things. One, I totally understand where you're coming from, and it is sort of refreshing, and it's funny that this movie really got shit on, and maybe some of that is because I do think that there are things in the movie that doesn't work, but I also think it's not hip to not like it, but I think there is a thing that a lot of critics in particular have, where it's like if you show them something this sort of nakedly positive, that they're just gonna be like, ugh, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's so childish, and yeah, it's such an immature version of the world. And there's some truth to that, and I think Darabont owns up to that this is this town represents an idealized America, not
exactly
the America as it is. But it's interesting to see a movie that's really mostly about people being good and wanting to be better, as opposed to most movies are about like people being shitty to each other, you know,
right.
Which doesn't make them bad. It's just, and look at The Mist. Darabont's next movie is 100% about people being shitty to each other. That's what the whole movie's about. This may be like, I don't know if it's a nitpick or whatever. Obviously, I'm trying to rewrite the movie, which isn't fair. But I do wish that during the stage where Jim Carrey has amnesia and he doesn't remember, you know, anything about himself, I do kind of wish that he asserted himself as a character in some way, because I don't feel like during that period we get to know anything about him as a person. I understand he doesn't remember his name or like where he's from, but that doesn't mean that his innate qualities don't still exist and could present themselves, because
he plays it maybe a little too blank.
Just he only exists right as people to be filled in by what other people tell him. And so I don't necessarily see how the town could fall in love with him, because all he is a projection of what they want him to be, what they remember him to be, as opposed to becoming his own person that then they say, well, I love this guy. It doesn't matter that he's not Luke.
Yeah, he plays it like a child almost, where it's just, you know, like he's being dragged along by his parents.
And it's the way it's written, too. It's not just Jim Carrey.
Yeah, it's not him. So, I mean, like, you raise a really good point there. One thing I'd like to get back to is just the reaction to this, to the movie.
Yeah.
Okay, I got one.
Three stars.
So I got one opinion that I think is pretty not surprising, and I got one opinion that is going to rile some feathers.
Oh,
and
boy.
I don't mean for it to.
Damn
but
it.
But here goes. I think part.
Sorry,
Patrick just fainted. it's all those Nolte impressions he's just spent. So the one that's not controversial is there's a habit for critics, if a movie comes out at the end of December in award season and doesn't blow them away, then it becomes the worst.
Okay.
And I think that was part of the problem with this movie, because it's a movie that really, to be successful, depended on critics liking it. It's not something where, it's not the typical Jim Carrey movie. It's not going to get, Jim Carrey movies get big audiences usually if it's a comedy, but if it's a drama, they tend to not. So this one really depended on kind of critics liking it, and they didn't, because it wasn't you know, that year it was A Beautiful Mind, or it was Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings.
I like this movie way more than A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah, I do.
For
too.
The record. Do you think, not to interrupt you, but real quick, do you think that that's like a conscious thing where they're just like, well, fuck this movie? Or do you think it's just because.
I think they get off on finding one or two movies to pick on.
I mean, I think that that might be true. I just wonder how much of it is that they're. That's also around the time that they are seeing some legitimately really good movies, because a lot of them come out around that time, and so now they're looking at this in comparison to something that's really good. Had this come out in April, they're not comparing it to brilliant movies like A Beautiful Mind, would they have liked it more?
I possibly I think this is a movie that, and this kind of ties into my next point, I think this is a movie that if it came out in 2011, the year The Artist won Best Picture, would have gotten a better reception than it did in 2001. Because
this movie is not that far removed from The Artist.
But it's also not very far removed time-wise, and I'm sorry if this is something that's kind of prickly. It came out 3 months after 9/11, and people were not in the mood to see Pie in the Sky
shortly
after 9/11.
Sure.
This is a real force feed for some people who were very, who still are feeling appropriately so, very raw and terrible about an awful event. And I just think that it's something that people just completely rejected because of that, just coming so shortly after it. So, I mean, I don't want to say, if it wasn't for 9/11, then like people would give Majestic the due that it's earned, because that's absurd, and I should be shot if I'm implying that. But I think there's something to be said for that.
I think you could be onto something. Yeah,
I think that's part of it.
Which now, like years removed from that, it's interesting because now when you consider that this came out so shortly after, it's like, oh, but doesn't this have a message that we needed to hear at that time about the greatness of America and what we can be? And obviously,
people kind of
not within
that,
3 months, you know, but
yeah, it's interesting because I mean, like, remembering back to those days, I mean, in the days after it, people really came together and it was a very kumbaya time, appropriately so. I mean, like, surprisingly enough, like, everybody just kind of, it seemed like their best character came out,
right?
But then shortly thereafter, I mean, like, that dissipated and it kind of got back to normal, sort of, but it also became a little bit more cynical.
Sure.
And I wonder if this came out like immediately after, if it came out in late September or in October, if it would have got even a different reception than it did in December once there's been some time removed. But I feel like certain critics didn't like it. There was a few contributing factors, and I think like a lot of people just kind of piled on. And I don't want to accuse critics of doing this, but I feel like there's, when I reread some of the blurbs, like the Rotten Tomatoes or the Metacritic reviews, they're all saying the same things. I mean, nobody has any individual thought anymore. They all say every reaction negative.
Too schmaltzy, exactly. Too long, it's indulgent.
Yeah, or like they find some way to, you know, use their fucking little New Yorker like snide comment, like however they can fit in their little clever jab. It's like, oh, thank God I finally have a movie to bring up like the Rosenbergs.
Where can
analogy.
I fit in erstwhile?
Apropos of nothing. I feel like there's just a tendency to pile on, and I wrote a column about it last year about movie bullying, and I feel like this is kind of it. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about The Majestic is in 2013 there were a lot of movies that people didn't like, critics didn't like, that I liked, that I wanted to support. In 2014 there's really not that many.
No.
And
just A Million Ways to Die in the West.
I like A Million Ways.
That's why I'm
it's
bringing
decent.
It up.
It's decent. That 3 Days to Kill was another one.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
I thought that was ridiculous, but very entertaining. But yeah, I think it's good for like a movie fan's soul to have a few movies like that a
definitely.
Year. To have ones that just no one likes, but you find something in and you stick up for. And that shows and I mean, I'm patting myself on the back, but that shows movie fan character, and you should have movie fan character, every single one of you.
Snow White and the Huntsman, everyone.
I know, exactly.
I agree that with a lot of what you're saying in terms of critical response, and I think that's only been made worse by the internet, because I think some of the internet... You know, the great thing about the internet is you can find any opinion on anything. So if you want to find people that like it, you probably can. But there's also a little bit of a hive mind, because people don't necessarily take the time to consider their own opinions. They just, they read 10 other things and they're like, that's kind of how I feel. And so it all just kind of snowballs into this one general consensus. But I do think, you know, that a lot of critics are reporting their honest reactions, and I think that this is a movie that sets itself up to be knocked down, if only because it is indulgent, and it is, as you said, Darabont cashing in all of his chips and making this sort of passion project, and almost any time that happens, it's not very good. This is probably one of the better ones that I've seen, you know. And because it is so optimistic, and it is 2.5 hours long, and it doesn't need to be 2.5 hours long, you know?
No.
Darabont has an editing problem with a couple of his movies. So I think it is kind of setting itself up to be knocked down by critics. And yes, certainly some critics then get too excited to, like, sharpen their knives, especially for a guy who has been celebrated up to this point, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing that kind of struck me as really odd, because... Everyone liked Shawshank. I mean, critics were the ones that really boosted that movie
up. Yeah, because people didn't really see it in the theater.
No, and Green Mile was well received, and
which I'm not totally sure why, but it's fine. Like, I don't hate it, but I never want to see it again.
I never have the urge to rewatch it. It's on TV a lot, but yeah, I never want to sit down and watch it again. But yeah, I mean, like, I thought that this one, even if you didn't like it, the more appropriate response would be like, yeah, it's a misfire.
Right.
It's not really that good. But, like, everybody just seemed to really love tearing it up.
Well, right, because you have Jim Carrey, who was maybe not still the biggest box office star in the world, but he was still up there. He was on his streak still. You have Darabont coming off a few major successes, and, you know, you have this movie released at the holidays, 2.5 hours long, kind of this epic thing. I mean, it's all sort of packaged as this big prestige thing, and so... I think it's way easier to construct a narrative that says it's a disaster than it is to say, well, it's a misfire. I like this and this, but these things maybe don't work. You know, if you just call it a disaster, you don't have to elaborate anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's way easier.
What do you think of the other performances? Were there any ones that you liked or didn't like?
I mean, everybody's fine. I think I think some of the performances are a little cartoonish. I think some of that is the way that they're written. I think, you know, he goes out of his way to create stock characters instead of living, breathing human beings.
He's got like a stock company. Like, it's almost like he just finds characters to fit in.
Which I like, actors. You know.
I like that too. Like Jeffrey DeMunn and James Whitmore.
Right.
I actually really like Laurie Holden in this movie.
That was where I wanted to go next.
How'd you feel about Laurie Holden?
I think she's fine. Like, I don't dislike her.
Okay.
I'm fascinated by what he likes so much about her, because he keeps casting her.
Yeah.
Like, she's kind of his discovery.
Yeah, she was. When I was doing some show prep, I came across a Charlie Rose episode that he did for The Majestic, and he said that they found Holden in an acting class with his assistant. His assistant was in an acting class, and Laurie Holden was in it, and she said, you know, this is that Adele person, so, like, take a look at her. And that's kind of what it was. And he, you know, auditioned her for like 7 months and stuff. And he wasn't even like really convinced until late in the process that it was her. But the thing that I like about her is she has a tendency of making, or she has a way of making really sanctimonious dialogue go down easy.
Okay.
And that's something that isn't easy to do. And I feel like a lot of it is, there's one part of the screenwriting that I think is smart, where they tie her love of the law to seeing a Paul Muni like lawyer movie. I don't even know if it's a real movie or not. I think it is. It was Emile Zola. And they tie it to that because it gives you, I mean, a lot of people are informed by entertainment on what they want to do with their lives. You know, I watched Siskel and Ebert and wanted to be a movie critic and stuff like that. So, I mean, like, there's certain things to that. And I think that that informs her speechifying later, and it makes it almost, I don't know, in a way, just like refreshing or kind of quaint. Whereas if she was just speechifying at Jim Carrey with no context to that, then it would seem really sanctimonious and tired.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like that. Again, I like Darabont's loyalty to actors, and I like that he keeps putting her in stuff. It's always weird when a movie like this comes along with a part like that, that you just assume is going to go to one of the new Hollywood it girls, you know, like, well, you're going to play opposite Jim Carrey. And
they call him an ingenue
in a new picture. And then they throw this curveball, and it's like, well, I don't know who that person is. Yeah. And it only happens every once in a while. I remember when Moonlight Mile came out and Ellen Pompeo was cast, and I
still haven't seen that. You said it was good, right?
I'm someday maybe gonna do a Movies I Love call on it, but it's been a while since I've watched it. But that's a movie like kind of like The Majestic, where it resists all of my cynicism. So I watch it, and I feel so then I want to see, like, okay, well, what does he see in her that he doesn't see in all these other maybe more famous actresses? And I watch it, and I feel like the performance is kind of dour and grim.
She's not real sunny.
No. And I think part of that is just true to the character. Like, she's a sad person who lost the love of her life and lives in a town where all of the young men have been sent to war and killed. Mm-hmm. So I think that informs some of it. But I think part of it too is just, we're just reacting to what any other actress would have done in that part. Like, if they put Renee Zellweger in there, it would have been more of like a movie star part.
It would have been Leatherheads.
But it would have been, you know, like, we want her to be like a little more adorable or a little more something other than what she is.
Yeah, like the hiccuping thing is something for like a lighter actress.
Yeah. So it's weird. You know, I see The Mist and I feel like it makes more sense in The Mist than it does in The Majestic.
She looks like a woman out of the 50s, I think. Pretty easily. The reason why I bring that up,
a grown-up Amy Smart.
Ooh, never grow up, Amy Smart. One thing that I heard this on another show, and I thought it was the funniest thing ever because they said it without missing a beat, and they didn't laugh at it after they said it. And it was the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. They're talking about Marion Cotillard and her in The Immigrant, the James Gray movie that takes place in the 1920s. And they said she has a great period face. And I kept thinking that when I was watching The Majestic, I'm like, she's giving period face.
You want to see my period face, Reggie?
I do it all 30 days of the month.
Do you have anything else to say about The Majestic?
It's so good. I really love it.
Rank the Darabonts.
Favorite is Shawshank Redemption, then The Majestic, then The Mist, then The Green Mile.
Okay, I mean, it's pretty easy to do with only four. I would probably flip The Majestic and The Mist, but other than that,
The Mist is awesome. The Mist is really great. I really like The Mist. I'm just a big fan of Darabont. I wish he did more work.
Me too. He's kind of in a TV thing right now, and I wish he would get out of it.
Nobody wants him.
No, he gets fired from creating the biggest show on TV.
The Mob City goes bust.
Nothing, Make another movie, man.
Yeah, exactly.
But then he writes, like, Indiana Jones sequels, and then they shit-can his script, so...
Exactly, yeah. I wonder how much of it is bullshit, though, because he says, like, you know, like, hey, George Lucas didn't like it, but Spielberg really loved it. And I'm like, did Spielberg?
Have you
really
read the script?
No, have you?
I have.
Can you? I didn't.
Yeah,
know
it's
you
online.
Can.
Yeah, oh, okay. It's online. I've read it, and my memory is that a lot of the things that are still in the movie and work come from Darabont's script.
Interesting.
And
is mud in it?
And that it resolves a lot of the problems.
Okay.
Mud is the worst.
Mud is horrible.
I rewatched Temple of Doom a couple weeks ago because it was the 30th anniversary of Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
And I have a weird on again, off again thing where, like, and I have this with Halloween 2 also, where I'll watch it and I'll be like, that's pretty good. And then the next time I watch it, I don't like it. And then I watch it again and I think, that's pretty good.
I have that with Funny People.
Okay.
Every time I watch it, I have a different opinion
about it. Every other viewing.
And it's never like, oh, I gradually like it a little bit more or a little bit less. It's always...
It's one or the other,
giant
right?
swings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I on this viewing of Temple of Doom, I liked it. And I wonder if it has to do with the last time I watched it was in preparation for Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and me and Erica and JB and Jan all got together and watched the first three movies right in a row. So I was watching it right after Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
And I think that does it a disservice because it's very different. And yeah. I feel like its flaws stand out more in comparison to Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I've never been the biggest Temple of Dune fan. Yeah. I like the set pieces that everyone likes, but yeah, I have a really tough time getting through the lulls in
yeah.
that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, The Majestic, everyone.
Yeah. I'm going to, you guys can't see this, but I'm giving Patrick a stopwatch to make sure the podcast always starts on time.
Nice. Nice. Anyway, thank you guys very much for yeah. listening.
Thank you for listening to my indulgent Majestic opinions.
If you have a movie nobody likes and you want to defend it, let me know. You can come on the podcast.
Exactly.
Anyway, thanks, Adam.
Goodbye, Patrick.
Goodbye, Nick.